This is the Dava Project.
I'm Dan Cottam from Grantham Museum. Throughout this series, I've been talking with historian Charles Fletcher about his research into the history of Dava Moor. Last episode, we heard how the dire circumstances led to a bloody murder. We are now talking about how the 18th century saw an end to a great many of the new farms and improvements on the Dava.
This is where the kind of repercussions of the famine come home to roost, as it were, for Sir James Grant of Grant, because all of a sudden he's in severe financial trouble. His debts are worth around £20 million in modern day kind of money, if you kind of take into account inflation like that. So his management of the estates has been pretty disastrous. He sells off as much land as possible without kind of breaking up the core of the estates, but still he's a long way short. So for years he's been kind of lenient and not really tried to evict any of the tenants who've not been paying their way, but I'm not sure it was that lenient, because obviously I think a lot of these farms, like the ones on the Dava, when people realized that they were not really worth anything at all, then they couldn't really find new tenants for them, so there wasn't really any point in evicting people, because you couldn't find anyone new to take their place. But nonetheless, by 1800, evictions were in swing. Definitely, there were large-scale evictions taking place. And this kind of ties in with what was beginning to happen elsewhere in the Highlands, especially on the Sutherland estates, where you see the big clearances there, kind of from the 1810, 1820s onwards. This is around the same time period. And it's kind of something similar. The only difference, I think, really in Strathspey is that there isn't really any resistance to what's going on, but these are still large-scale removal of tenants legally undertaken. And the interesting thing as well is that the grants used the same legal firms, the same people as were later used in the Sutherland clearances. So their main lawyer was the Elgin-based lawyer Thomas Seller, and they made use of his son, the notorious Patrick Seller, to remove tenants on Dava Moor, amongst others. So quite a lot of the new improvements which were created in the 1750s and 1760s, which you can still see traces of them today if you look really hard, but for the casual observer, you probably wouldn't notice them when you're crossing the moor. But most of these ones were cleared around 1800 or incorporated into the ones which remained, but quite a lot of tenants. It's estimated, I haven't got the exact numbers, but several hundred tenants and subtenants from Strathspey were cleared around 1800.
People really were at the end of their tethers anyway. So when you say there's no resistance, it wasn't worth putting up a fight for. You've not been able to pay your rent for a decade?
Yeah, in some cases. So it's amazing how much, or like how many years arrears some people were in. Like you say, literally some people over a decade they hadn't paid any rent for. When you're not able to make any money at all from the land, it's like, are you really worth fighting for, or is it really worth fighting for it? I guess that's one of the other big differences. When you talk about the Sutherland clearances and stuff, people were being cleared from really, really good productive farmland, whereas in Strathspey they were being removed from pitiful land in quite a lot of cases. I mean, some of the removals were from the better farms, like lime kilns and stuff like that. They lodged papers to remove the McQueens from lime kilns because they weren't able to pay their rent. And that's obviously, along with Renecra, lime kilns is the biggest, certainly, of the farms on Dava. But it's not something which is really talked about in terms of Strathspey and stuff like that. But there was a lot of clearances undertaken by the grants. There was a lot of removal of people around 1800.
Yeah, it's not something that it is talked about a lot in Strathspey at all, really. You kind of hear the opposite, that they really what it didn't go on, but it's that nuance is really of the difference between a clearance and an eviction. That's almost the key, because people will go, well, they'll forgive you for clearing someone off their land who's not paid the rent, for a decade. But actually, the policies that came before that have put these people into that situation where they were just doomed to failure from the beginning, mowed it out, the Seafields put in their, like, kept pouring money into their investment, basically, because the goal, we tried this big experiment, we need to, let's try and make it work as you would do. So you would put all of your, take all of your funds and try and make it work until at the point where it really is never going to work.
Well, then, interestingly, Interestingly, it probably didn't really cost the Grant family very much money.
Yeah.
Until like you say, they had to put money into supporting their starving tenantry, and until they had to the main reason they lost money was soaking up the kind of not getting the income from the cattle money. But all the improvements were paid for by the tenants. So in some cases, when tenants renounced their leases or were evicted from the Dava, they tried to reclaim the money that they'd spent on ploughing and building walls and houses and things like that. But it's not clear whether they actually got the money back. But I guess that's the only kind of fight that people were putting up, was trying to recoup some of the money that they'd put into these complete waste of time, basically. They were just completely unviable. So they were probably quite angry that they'd been put in the situation in the first place.
Where do all of these Strathspey families kind of end up?
Well, I imagine quite a lot of them probably got soaked up by the new towns that were being built, like Grantown and other towns across the northeast of Scotland. Someone else had done some research on some of this, and they found that quite a lot of people from Strathspey went to Glenlivet and the Cabarrick area. Strangely, I'm not sure why, but there's some kind of link that quite a lot of the Grant people who were cleared from Strathspey and didn't resettle there went further east. And then there's obviously also this new evidence that people from Strathspey were going to America at the end of the 18th century. So there is a kind of people spreading out all over Scotland. Many were probably attracted by life in the towns and the cities, as well as working as labourers on farms, things like this, definitely getting away from trying to be farmers.
Then further into the 1800s, there's less people up there with now larger farms, because they're kind of amalgamating. As people leave, basically the farms are just getting bigger with less people in them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So you've got this kind of consolidation. So there's kind of two rounds of clearances on the Dava. There's the first one, which we've just talked around 1800. And this was getting rid of people who were basically in arrears of rent. This was like all the failed farms which didn't work. But then there was still a lot of farms left up there. There's probably around 30 farms. So a lot more than you'd think about today. But they soak up the grazings and whatever these other people have managed to break in as arable land. And it makes their farms not really kind of lucrative, but just about viable. Some of them are really small crofts. Shendale and Cornelock and things like this. They're pretty miserable farms, but they're probably viable as a small holding. And these places survived until around 1870, and in the late 1860s, around 1870, there's another round of clearances on the moor, which is that's when you kind of get, I suppose, what the moor really looks like today is kind of owes it to that second round of clearances. The Strathspey estate, the Seafields, they paid for a big survey of all their land in 1860. Basically, they wanted to get more rent. That was the reason they paid for this huge survey. Every bit of tenanted land that they owned was surveyed, and they made recommendations of how they could make more money out of it. And basically one of the main recommendations was to eliminate the small crofters on the estate, get rid of them. So that's what happened on the Darver. And so lots of the smaller crofts were again combined to make sheep farms, or to make bigger farms for sheep to graze on the moor. Again, it's not really a malicious thing. It's just to try and increase their rentals and to try and recoup some more money. So they kind of envisage, again, combining all these small farms which have survived and then moving the people to Grand Town and making them into agricultural laborers again. It's the thing that you just see all across the Highlands happening the whole time. It's just that in different places, it obviously happened in different ways. There was some resistance this time round, though. There was definitely more criticism the second time than there was the first time. Because in 1883, there was the Napier Commission. So the Napier Commission was an investigation into the condition of crofters throughout the Highlands and the Islands of Scotland. Because obviously there was all this kind of uproar in the national press about the clearances during this time, and the Napier Commission went to Canusie. And some crofters from the braes of Castle Grant and the edge of Darver made presentations to the committee at Canusie. So we know some of the stuff and kind of contemporary opinion that was going on about what was happening on the Seafield estates. And generally speaking, the tenants really liked the Seafields. Surprisingly, they actually blamed the crofters themselves for getting into trouble and their kind of economic fortunes not working out. They said it's not really the Seafield's fault, it's the crofters' fault themselves. So it's kind of an interesting clash of opinions. There were some people who thought that it was a terrible thing that they'd been clearing people on the farm to make people on the moor, sorry, to make big farms. There's kind of really two examples of this. So they create Attendow, which is east of Darver Station. That was one of the sheep farms that they created in 1870. And there was quite a lot of criticism about that because they moved probably about four families, or cleared four families and then replaced them with one tenant. And they did the same at Glen Tarrock on the west side of the moor, where they got rid of Cornerlock and Shendale and Glen Gower and some of these other crofts. But they're kind of, it's not as big as the first round in 1800. It's a lot smaller. But there was some criticism that people didn't like it on the whole. And this is why the moor kind of looks like it did, or it does at the moment. It's also when they started building the modern stone houses really around this time as well, because this is when the Seafields pump in millions and millions of pounds into building all the stone farmhouses and outbuildings and byres and roads and things that you see today. It all happened at this point in time.
So this is where instead of the tenants renting the land and improving their own in a way their own buildings and things, now the estate, John Charles, is improving all the larger, now kind of semi-large farms. He's investing in the infrastructure and the buildings in these farms. But the tenants then don't have, and they then charge more rent then before the improvement to pay for it.
Yeah, precisely. So the capital expenditure is coming from the estate, whereas before it was coming from the tenants. But it's not so good for the tenants because they just put the rent up hugely. So for instance, the rent of Glen Tarrock between 1867 and 1870, it went up at 400%. So the rent increases in some cases were huge to pay for these slight enlargement of the land and the new buildings and stuff that we're putting up. So it was definitely passed on to the tenants in the end. The other thing which happened in the 1860s is the sporting side of things really starts to kick off. So they've on the Dava, obviously the main thing that we kind of associate with sporting is Lochendorb Lodge, which was built in the middle of the 19th century. A couple of the crofts were cleared. The people were evicted so that they could use the fields for putting in the ponies and the horses for shooting and stalking on the hills. So that's another manifestation. Then obviously as well, they start managing the grouse numbers. And this was very unpopular with the crofters because nice for the grouse, they can just go and eat all the corn that people were growing on the moor. And that's something that you hear people like Nan Fraser complaining about still in the 1950s. So it's something which definitely haunted the people up there for quite a while after it started in the middle of the 19th century.
Yeah, start giving over like half of that land where people are trying to grow crops to growing birds that will eat those crops so that you can shoot the birds.
Yeah, I know. It's bonkers, isn't it? It's bonkers when you think about it.
Really, it's at this point where like the whole Highland landscape is completely transformed from that model, that agricultural model, to hunting and shooting. Is the trains coming in around the 1860s, up to Highlands and up to Grantown,
indeed Dava.
Stop at Castle Grant. That hunting, shooting, and fishing comes in, and it's big, big business for the landowners. Suddenly, it's like, wow, people, our peers, are able to give us loads of money for a bit of our Highland land, so they can rent it for the summer. And we'll grow the birds, the wild birds, we'll make sure that they are plentiful so that people can enjoy shooting them, and we'll make more money from that. But the kind of model at that point if I'm not wrong, it's renting out chunks of the land to other rich people. It's not rich people coming up so much and being treated by the laird. It's each person kind of having their little patch of the moor.
Precisely. Renting a shooting or a whole estate commercially from the sea fields. Precisely. Whereas before, the model would have been that if you were aristocratic and entitled, you might have been invited by the Laird of Grant or the Earl of Seafield to partake in some of his sport. Now you had to pay for the privilege. The nouveau riche from England and the Midlands would come up and pay a large amount of money. I suppose it didn't make too much of a difference for the people on the Dava, besides having flocks of grouse descending upon your crops. There wasn't really that much of a change from the sporting side, whereas other parts of Strathspey, obviously like Abernethy Forest and bits of Duffel, they were changed much more dramatically by this kind of shift over to sporting, because obviously they cleared quite a lot of the crofts and the farms in Abernethy Forest to turn it into a deer run for stalking and things like that. So the Dava was kind of, and Cromdale Parish as a whole was kind of left relatively untouched by that, apart from Lochendorb Lodge, and then obviously more gamekeepers and things like that on the moor, so they build cottages for them. But what changed it more was probably the arrival of the railway, as you mentioned, in 1863. Railway arrives 1863, just before all these other new clearances happen. They build a station at Dava, and then all of a sudden the Dava's gone from being, I mean, it was on the military road, so it wasn't a complete backwater, but all of a sudden it's on the main transport artery between Inverness and the rest of the UK. So obviously there's an influx of new people to the Moor. We've already talked about the sporting side brought in some new people, but then the railway brings considerably more for people to work at the station, and then Lensman. So you get new houses being built at Huntley's Cave and Heatherbell and Dava Station.
And it's the building of a railway as well. It's not just the railway coming and bringing things in, but it's that crucial point where suddenly people have employment. There would have been a good many jobs building a station.
Yeah, and carting and moving things around like that. If you've got horses and things like that, definitely there would be work for local people. I'm not actually sure that the railway probably made that much of a difference to life on the Dava for most people. When you talk to people like the Coots and Nan Fraser, they didn't really use the railway because it was too expensive. Unless you worked for the railway company themselves and then you got reduced fares, for most people, they were still just walking everywhere. And they couldn't, you know, if you're still living this kind of hand-to-mouth existence, these farms haven't suddenly magically got more productive. The rents have gone up dramatically, but they haven't become any more lucrative. So you can hardly afford to buy train tickets to go places. So I'm not convinced that the arrival of the railway probably made that much of a difference to life on these farms on the Dava. I mean, it brought new people, and temporarily it would have brought new work, but I don't think really it probably made that much of a difference in the long term. I suppose the other thing which really happened in the 19th century on the Dava is the school, which was opened after the Education Act. So that probably had much more of an impact on life on the Dava, because the Education Act really, that's probably one of the main things which changed culture and society in the Highlands. When we were talking about the murder before that, most of the people who they interview in those for the court case and things like that, they're monoglot Gaelic speakers. They don't speak any English. And it's the same throughout the 19th century. Most of the people on the Moor, they mainly just speak Gaelic. Even by the end of the 19th century, half of the people up there, they speak Gaelic. After the Education Act wipes out Gaelic in one generation. So it's one of the biggest changes to life probably up there. You're getting an education which is in English, and you're encouraged to go out into the world and make something of yourself and not stay on a farm. So that's probably one of the main things which changed in the 19th century.
Help me through the, what exactly was the Education Act? What did it say?
So the Education Act basically established schooling, free schooling for all in Scotland. So before that, schooling was run by private bodies. So you kind of had like the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge. They were one of the main people who provided schooling. So they were mainly like religious institutions. They were kind of, there weren't any uniform standards. It was kind of informal. You would, you know, each person would, a family would pay the schoolmaster for his upkeep and things like that. And you'd get a number of competing schools who were funded by different bodies. So it's kind of a very ad hoc system, and you didn't have to go to school. Whereas after the Education Act, the government starts providing schooling for everyone. For children on the Dava, because they lived quite a long way from a school before that, this is probably the first school that a lot of them attended. And the other important thing, as I mentioned, in Cromdale Parish, the school boards had the opportunity, they could decide what language they taught in. So they could decide whether schooling was in Gaelic or English. And in Cromdale, even though 50% of the people in the parish spoke Gaelic, they decided that it would be 100% in English. So the first teacher on the Dava was a Miss Coventry, who spoke no Gaelic whatsoever, but terribly good English. I think this is probably a much bigger change. All of a sudden, your children have got to start going to school every day. and they're learning in English, and then they're getting an education. In many cases, they probably didn't want their children to have to struggle through the same existence that they had had. So if they can get an education, they can speak English and they can go out into the world and become a school teacher or something like that, then by all means, they'd want them to leave.
One of the major impacts that the Education Act has, therefore, is just that switch. Where Gaelic is a predominant language to, like, in a generation, people are speaking English, because actually everyone is encouraging you to speak. The schools are discouraging you from speaking Gaelic. And your parents are going, yes, on you go, learn English, because that's how you'll get on in the world. It is more like we would go to university to learn Mandarin nowadays.
Yeah, literally.
Language is power. It's really important. So actually, it's where that switch to, we have to, as Gaelic speakers, we're going to have to learn English because we don't want to be stuck in this situation anymore.
It is amazing. And it's precisely, like you say, that's exactly what happened. It wasn't these earlier things like Culloden and things like that which killed Gaelic and Gaelic culture. It was education, ironically. And the result on Dartmoor, if you take that as a specific case, is around, like I say, at the end of the 19th century, just 1890s, you've got nearly 400 people probably living on the Dartmoor, 300 to 400, 150 of whom spoke Gaelic. By the time that we're the 1950s, when we talked, or when Nan Fraser was telling us about, and other people who lived on the moor, there's only, she could think of maybe one person who knew a bit of Gaelic, who was at Tirriemore, Bob Tirriemore's mother, I think, and also maybe Jane MacDonald, who lived at Renecra. Some people say that she could speak Gaelic. So that's, in 50 years, that's gone from being, you know, 150, 200 people who could speak Gaelic to one. One generation, it's gone, which is amazing when you think how long it lasted before that and everything that it had gone through. The school records that are left from the Dartmoor School give some quite interesting reading. Again, it's another way that we can kind of see what life was like at the end of the 19th century up there, because Miss Coventry kept a school logbook, like all other teachers in Scotland. And so there's daily entries from the school in Dartmoor telling. Most of it's not very interesting. Most of it's just what the children have been doing each day, how many children attended. But it's quite interesting seeing how many people actually turn up, because again, in the 1880s, just like the 1780s, the weather takes a very much a turn for the worse. So quite a lot of her logbook entries record probably the horror from someone from, I think she might be from Edinburgh, turning up and moving to 1,000 feet above sea level in the Highlands and having to put up with winters where the snow lies on the ground from October to March and none of the scholars can get to school because they're all snowed in for 6 months. So it kind of lays bare the difficulties. It's all very well having a school, but it's not necessarily simple that they can all get there. In many respects, it wasn't really that different to how it was in the 1750s. And this is, I think, one of the things we kind of were interested in when we started this project was, or it's what a lot of people are interested in the modern day. They see all these abandoned houses up on the moors. They go and have a look around and they're like, you know, the kettle's still on the hob and the coat's on the hook. And they're like, why did they just walk out? Why did the people leave? And I think really the main reason is, even though you've got the railway, you've got a school, is that life for people up there on these small crofts and marginal farms, it wasn't really any different to how it was in 1750. It was hardly different at all. And it wasn't even by the time we got to 1950 and we start talking to Nan Fraser and the Coots and people like that. It's not really changed. It's the same. It's the same lifestyle they're leading in the 1950s as they were in the 1750s. The only difference is they've got the radio and a slate roof over the top of them instead of a thatched one. And that's the reason why people left, is because they wanted something which wasn't a difficult, antiquated existence at the end of the day. Because life up there was hard. I suppose it's kind of almost gone back to how it was before they started trying to live up there full time. There's two farmers who are still in the summertime, got cows and sheep on the moor. So it's kind of it's obviously a tiny number of animals compared to its heyday in the 17th century. But I suppose it's kind of gone back to, it's almost like it's people have struggled for over 200 years to make a living up there. But then in the end, they've kind of just admitted that it's not... It's not really working out.
It's only good for cows and sheep, and only that in the summertime.
And only that in the summertime. I think that's the enduring lesson to take away. But it's sure got a fascinating story to tell when you look into it, and you wouldn't really suspect it when you kind of you just kind of cross there, or you're walking across or driving across. You'd never believe the kind of the human stories and the kind of bigger things which were going on over the past few hundred years up there. I suppose it's almost like the Highlands in microcosm. If you think about it, it kind of represents many of these bigger movements and things which have been going on, but in a kind of individual way. But it's definitely a fascinating example of kind of social engineering. It's not what you'd expect at first glance.